The curse of the devil. Exorcism or sacrifice. Blessing or bestiality. The curse of the devil. Satan in control of the body and the mind.
My love will destroy the creation.
Hello and welcome to episode 31.5 of the Nashie Cast. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we are here for the first in a long while of 0.5 episodes.
Yes, and yes, it has been a while. If you base your life around waiting for 0.5 episodes, you have my sympathies.
If you've been holding your breath, you're dead.
Yeah.
So we're here to do a 0.5 episode. 0.5s are where we take the opportunity to talk about non-Nashie films that are Spanish horror. And we love these kind of things because it allows us to explore areas where sometimes the films intersect with Nashie, sometimes they don't, but they're always very interesting, and there's just no way to really get into the Paul Nashie filmography without being drawn eventually into other areas of Spanish horror, and these 0.5 episodes give us the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Past episodes, we've talked about the first of the Blind Dead movies and... Mm-hmm.
Strange Loves of the Vampire, we've done.
Horror Express, mm-hmm. which is a very popular one. Mm-hmm. And
Cutthroats 9, we did.
Cutthroats 9, another one. And this is one where we have touched upon the filmmaker of this particular film twice before, because he kind of looms large in Spanish exploitation and horror over the past 40 years.
Yeah.
Easily, yeah, exactly, actually 40 years, mm-hmm. now that I think of it.
This will be the third film of his we've done.
Yeah, we've done two before, and of course his name is Jess Franco, and
or Clifford Brown. If you look at the if you read the credits of this film we're doing tonight.
Ah, yes, he does hide behind many pseudonyms depending on various and sundry things.
Yep.
But this is the apparently up until the release of this on DVD, quite a difficult film to see from his oeuvre. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Over.
I've never been sure how to pronounce.
Actually, I normally pronounce that word just fine, and now it's as if suddenly I'm stoned or something. I can't say it anyway. From his filmography, there.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll use a multi-syllable word, and not one derived from a foreign tongue. There.
Yeah.
Filmography. Now, soon I'll be using stupid words like, you know, quadrilogy, stupid made up shit.
Quadrilogy, yeah, that's a great one.
Could you believe that when they did that?
It's like quadrilogy, are you kidding me?
It's
really
called a tetralogy, people. Yeah, a tetralogy. Yeah. Look the freaking words up. Oh, jeez. It's like people are, well, if it's a trilogy, it must be a quadrilogy. No, dumbass. It's a tetra. It's four. Jesus, look at the... All right, sorry. Stepping off.
Stepping off the rant there.
Oh, God. That was my apologies to everyone for starting that ignorant stab in the dark at anger. Okay, folks, 31.5. We're going to talk about another Jess Franco film. And, of course, the reason we've decided to go back and do another Jess Franco film is to specifically pull one out that we're interested in seeing and hadn't seen before, but also one that allowed us to talk a little bit about the recently passed Lena Romay.
Yeah.
Lena Romay, there's a lot to say about Lena Romay. Yeah. She starred primarily in nothing but films by Jess Franco. They were inseparable for decades. Once they started their collaboration together, she was not just an actress in his films. She was... to use the word most often used, his muse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She co-wrote films with him. She sometimes directed films herself under a pseudonym of her own. What was it? Candy Coster.
You're right, yeah.
And she was his constant companion and creative soulmate for decades. Mm-hmm. And her passing from cancer just this year was a very sad thing, and something that I know I was not expecting.
Yeah,
she always seemed so vibrant and alive.
Yeah,
and she's one of those people that you've seen in so many movies that you just never really think of as someone who will eventually pass away.
I know.
It's her passing that had us both thinking, you know, we maybe need to do a film that she plays a prominent part in so that we can talk about her.
Right.
Because I don't know about you, she is one of the things that, even when I'm watching a Jess Franco film that I don't particularly enjoy, Mm-hmm. If she's in it, there's at least something that I find interesting.
Yeah, I agree. You never get tired of looking at her, not just because she's beautiful, but she also has a great screen presence, and she's always interesting in what she does.
I will argue, especially as we go through this particular movie, I will argue that I think she's one hell of a good actress.
Oh, I thought she's terrific in this.
but I would say not just in this. So, but we'll talk about that more as we go on.
Okay.
Since this episode is going to focus primarily on Lena Romay, we'll talk about her. We'll talk about her to begin with. Then we'll get into this particular film, Lorna the Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about my frustration with that title.
Oh well, yeah, okay, God, we could talk at long length about our frustration with that title. But
and we'll get into a discussion of it. We'll try to play this one fast and loose and not do. It would really kind of be hard to spoil this film in a lot of ways, but I think I'm going to try to stay away from a lot of the details.
And I'll try to do that too. And we kind of do that with these point fives. You know, we don't necessarily go scene by scene like we do with a lot of the regular episodes. We sort of just try and give you a little overview of some things we know, you know, and some of our thoughts about it, and kind of, you know, leave it to you to go out and, you know, experience it.
More of a blanket overview than a point by point dissection. And the reason I think we want to do that with the point fives is it leaves room for your exploration, and it allows you to, this film is actually easy to get a hold of.
Yeah, that's true. That's another.
We'll talk about this release of it too. DVD release of it, which is just a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is.
But that's kind of the structure of how we're going to go about this. We're going to talk a little bit about Jess Franco again, as we did in the first two episodes that focused on his movies, and then we'll end the podcast with a little feedback, and then we'll go on from there. So we'll take a quick break, come right back, and dive into Lena Romay and Lorna the Exorcist. First, let's talk a little bit about Lena Romay. As we've already talked about, she was for 30 plus years, Jess Franco's constant companion, creative partner, muse, however you want to say it. Starred in innumerable movies for Jess Franco, both horror movies as well as porno movies and everything else under the sun. This was a woman who described herself as an exhibitionist.
Mm-hmm.
And was willing to do damn near anything on screen. And
film pretty much attested that.
Yeah. Although there's no actual porn in
this. It's not Triple X or anything.
No.
Apparently there were some, was done for most of these films, you know. But I'm not sorry that those actually didn't end up in the film, you know. If they filmed like Triple X.
Well, they always seem to be... there always seem to be inserts that different producers, you know, would slip into. Okay,
I'm sitting here thinking, he just said insert, and then he said slip into, and I'm like, am I going to have to? But the thing is, those call him out here.
Those are the correct terms to use. They're called inserts, and they would be put into films that to turn them into X-rated films, whether or not the cast was actually involved in the pornographic scenes or not. So. Oh, Lord. Anyway, let's talk about Lena Romay, a woman who did just about everything that you can probably do on screen. Her actual name, she was born in 1954 with the name Rosa Maria Almirall Martinez.
That's a beautiful name.
Yes, indeed.
Bit of a mouthful, but a beautiful name.
Martinez. I used to work with a guy whose name was Martinez, and I had a Southern gentleman who worked with us who wanted to refer to him as Martinez.
Martinez. Martinez.
I say Southern gentleman and not redneck.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, right.
But she took the name Lena Romay as a stage name. She took the name Lena Romay from an actress and jazz singer of that name from the 1940s. I cannot tell you a single thing about the real Lena Romay, but I wish I could.
Mm-hmm.
But for better or worse, everyone knows her as Lena Romay. The stage name stuck, same way that everybody knows Jess Franco as Jess Franco instead of Jesus Franco Manera.
You're right, right.
So she, as I've said, was definitely an exhibitionist and starred in a number of X-rated films, generally directed by Jess Franco. Mm-hmm.
Well, she would have been 20 when you made the film we're talking about tonight. Then
yes, she would have been 20, yeah. And that's something that I was kind of curious about as I started watching the movie because mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what year it came out, but the film came out in 1974,
mm-hmm.
which would have made her 20,
mm-hmm.
and she's playing a girl who's 18, and.
A rare case of an actress playing pretty much her age.
Especially in this type of film.
Right, sure. Yeah.
Generally where you're going to be doing this kind of thing and you're playing a teenager, generally the actress is going to be a little bit older just to make sure that they're no legal
hassle. Yeah, sure, okay. You know, we're all, you know, don't want to spend any prison time.
Yeah, we don't want to end up in the pokey. She began appearing in Jess Franco's films from about the time they met in 1971. She appeared in more than 100 feature films. Most of them directed by Jess Franco. She did occasionally appear, very rarely, but she did occasionally appear in films directed by somebody else. Rolls Royce Baby is one that I know of for sure that was directed by someone else. A lot of adult porn films, of course. Mm-hmm. But with Jess Franco, she made everything from horror films to comedies and even the occasional action-adventure or spy film. So,
yeah.
A little bit of everything in there.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably best known for a female vampire or bare-breasted countess, whatever mm-hmm. title you want to know it under.
Mm-hmm.
Also probably, Jack the Ripper, she had a nice little role in. Not a big role. Barbed Wire Dolls, which is one of my favorite prison women in prison films directed mm-hmm. by Jess Franco. She was in a whole lot of movies, and I liked a whole lot of them.
Yeah.
I don't think they're necessarily good. I've talked before about how I find female vampire to be just a big giant mess.
Mm-hmm.
But I found Dorianna Gray to be very fascinating. Night of the Skull, or Night of the Killers from 1976, is mm-hmm. one of my favorite little underknown pulp mm-hmm. stories that Franco made. Really enjoyed her in Mansion of the Living Dead, where she's kind of comedically amusing in a pretty fascinating Living Dead film from 1982. No matter what, though, whenever she's in the film, she is arresting. There's something about her.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And always enjoy seeing her in anything that she did. And the thing that you will learn very quickly about watching Lena Romay on screen is that, in general, you're probably going to see more of her than you think.
Yeah.
She is going to disrobe.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe as close as a viewer can become intimate with somebody on a screen, you will feel like you've almost had carnal knowledge of this woman via Jess Franco's click camera.
Well, yes, this I will tell you.
Jess Franco's camera is a big penis a lot of times.
I wanted to make note of this because in Lorna the Exorcist, we can segue into talking about this, but before we get into a discussion of the plot, I would like to point out that I think that in Lorna the Exorcist, I have seen all of Lena Romay. Except for two specific areas that I could pinpoint after going through the movie, and I don't think that I've seen exactly what her little toes look like. I'm not sure. Definitely not on the left foot. Yeah. I'm not positive.
We didn't look down her ear canal.
Well, no. Yeah. I also don't know exactly what her asshole looks like.
Mm.
And yes, I'm pretty sure I have never seen that area of flesh just behind her earlobes. Other than that, I think I pretty much know exactly what Lena Romay looked like at the age of 20.
If Jess Franco could have gotten a camera into those areas you mentioned, we would know. We would.
If he had five
these days of fiber optic camera, he would be using the.
I am sure that there is footage that was probably just edited out for various and sundry reasons. Maybe the film wasn't exposed correctly, or something of this nature. Maybe I don't know.
That's right.
Well, but in this film alone, I am pretty sure I've seen it all.
Yeah.
And this is not the first film I've ever seen her in. This is just the one where I thought to myself, okay, yes, we've covered pretty much every square inch of her body.
Now. Yeah, yeah.
It does not extend, like some of these films with her in it, to what I refer to as, although at times I began to worry, it wasn't quite a gynecological exam.
Yeah, yeah. But it,
but it did come. It, pretty, yeah. Let's state up front. This movie, if you're at least, if you're in the least bit uncomfortable with, say, highly erotic softcore pornography, if it gives you the itchy willies, this is not the film for you, because this movie is as close to porn as you're gonna get without it actually being a porn film. I mean,
this film's actually a pretty kinky, pretty sick puppy here. No, yeah, it's a pretty, I got to thinking
about it, and this movie to me, it reminds me of that childhood game you played with your siblings in the back seat of the car, the I'm not touching you game. This movie is as close to porn as it can be. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. I'm not quite porn. I'm not quite porn.
Yeah, I know.
I'm almost just, porn, but I'm not quite porn. I'm not quite. See? And you keep waiting for somebody to pull the car over and go, either fucking be porn or not be porn. Shut the fuck up. Because that's how close. That's what it felt like after a while. But, hey, I have nothing against pornography.
No.
But this is not Triple X, level insertion.
No.
Wow, here we go. No. Yes, no, this is not what that is. It is highly erotic. It is very, very close.
I was going to say, in a lot of ways, it's more erotic, though, and perverse than so many of those films are, you know, than a lot of Triple X films, are. It's, you know, in its own way, it's much more, it's more subversive than, in so many ways, than just a typical, you know, porno film.
yes. This is quite subversive in a number of ways. Yeah. Some of the ideas it plays around with. Let's talk about the plot to begin with.
Well, I tell you what, can we say one more thing about Lena Rimmo while we're just talking about her? I did, forgive me for not having my Franco timeline totally ingrained in my mind, but I was trying to, there's always that parallel that's going to be drawn between her and Soledad Miranda.
Right.
As kind of the two main muses most associated with Franco. Has Soledad Miranda already passed on before she made her first film with Franco, or was he making films at the same time? Because my impression was, I thought Soledad Miranda had died.
She passed away.
So Lena Romay could be very easily be seen as kind of, you know, his replacement muse, or the woman that came. Because you think of those two actresses, and they're so much of a type, you know. You could stand them next to each other. You know, they could probably almost be sisters, you know. And but I think it's interesting to think of what, you know, what Lena Romay, what her career might have been, or had, you know. The thing about Soledad Miranda is, I'm not sure that she was heading on that road to being just Franco's muse. She might have been heading to be a little more than that, in the sense of, the impression I get was she was close on the verge of maybe about to become a star when she died. She was getting an awful lot of attention, and she was, you know, attention, and the fact also, I think she might have been already either married or in another relationship. I mean, I don't think she was his companion, Jess Franco's companion. Now, I may be wrong about that,
I was thinking about that.
So, you know, Lena Romay might still have ended up where she was, because I don't know that Soledad Miranda would have ended up being like Lena Romay, just made exclusively, pretty much, worked with Franco. I think she was kind of going down a different...
I think you're right. You know. Here's the horrible thing. Soledad Miranda made I think 6 films with Jess Franco. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember to save my life if she made films with other directors during that period of time where she was making films with Jess. But it has always been my impression, and I'm pretty sure this is true, that Lena Romay came after her.
I was thinking,
and the sense that I've always gotten, and I don't know if I've read this somewhere or heard this in an interview with Franco or with Lena or whatever, that essentially Lena was essentially a kind of, maybe replacement is too strong a word, but
it sounds colder than I'm meaning it to.
You're right. I don't know that he
calculated that as like, I need another Soledad, now the Soledad's gone, but it's just the type that he's drawn to. You know, obviously that's what he pitched, always liked his...
Yeah.
His, you
and,
know.
And the thing is that women are always, and this is something that I find fascinating about his movies, women are always the center of his films in one way or another.
Yeah.
Either, even if they're not the main characters, and very often women are the main characters, the focus of the story is always around women. mm-hmm. either a morbid or sexual fascination with them, mm-hmm. or in the comedies, a kind of lustful desire for them. Mm-hmm. In some of his movies, an object of love or an object of wish fulfillment at times. A lot of times, wish fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And once you realize that about his movies and how central women are to them, you can understand why he would want someone who he found personally, physically attractive to work with over a period of time. Yeah. Someone he felt he could feel moving to him. Someone who would kind of key off of his creativity.
Yeah. Right. Someone who was comfortable with someone who he knew that, like, hey, I can throw anything at you. You know, you're with me on whatever I want to do. You know, you're comfortable with, you know, we have this comfort zone here, you know, this acknowledgement here, you know, that I can always rely on you to, you know, to not, like, suddenly freak out over, you know, all the weirdness I want to do in film.
There's that. And the thing about it is, if you look at the films he did with Soledad, like She Killed in Ecstasy or Vampires Lesbos, mm-hmm. she was in Count Dracula with him, of course, mm-hmm. and you see that in with both Soledad and with Lena, he looked into, maybe it wasn't luck, but he looked into someone who's not just a beautiful woman, but who also had an amazing screen presence and an ability to emote
just
on
mesmerizing
screen.
On the screen, and could play some of the, you know, comedies and the horror and the eroticism. I mean, they were not one note actresses, you know, and then that was very crucial to be able to bring off his stuff there.
Now, the thing about Lena is that I'm not sure if Soledad would have been able to be the collaborator that Lena turned into.
Right.
And I think that I was looking over Lena's filmography and kind of trying to pinpoint where I thought that she may have started to actively influence the kinds of stories that he was putting on film. And I don't know that I can, because who knows where one starts to influence the other.
That's a good point.
And back and forth, because he is, at the end of the day, the director and usually the writer, if not almost always the writer. Mm-hmm. And there's this desire within me to kind of almost try to assign, you know, we're film nuts, so we have a tendency to subscribe to the whole auteur theory, which is patently ridiculous a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk to any filmmaker with any, you know, sense of reality of life, and they'll tell you the same thing, which is, yeah, the auteur theory is really kind of nice, but once you start, it's way too collaborative.
Film is too much of a group, you know, it takes too many people to make a film for it, you know, really, you know, for it to totally boil down to, you know.
No one person can be in charge of every single thing on a film. It's just too damn large.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you're talking about the smaller budgets and smaller stories that somebody like Franco's doing.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about Franco films, especially after you see a number of them, you can start to see how the auteur theory can play very heavily into how you look at his work.
Yeah. I mean, even somebody like John Cassavetes, who basically, filmed his stuff on one camera, but because he had his actors totally improv, then just by that nature, they're going to take the story where it's going to, you know, took his films where they're, you know, going to go.
It was Cassavetes setting up the situations and giving the outline at the very least for the scenes, or setting up the script and saying, we can throw this out the window if it doesn't quite work, but he was still the man setting things in place. He was setting up the board and putting the pieces on it, and if the pieces moved in their own accord, that was fine.
But
he was still an auteur to a certain degree. Cassavetes' films is always going to feel like a Cassavetes' films.
Yeah.
So, in that same way, I think we have Franco, and I couldn't find a point. I think there are certain films where I look at them and I go, this really feels like the two of them were kind of thinking along the same lines and kind of rubbing up against each other and thinking, this would be neat for me and for you to play this.
Yeah.
And, Dorian Gray.
I haven't seen that one. That's why.
All I have is the XXX version, the porn version. It is an absolutely fascinating film, and that's the film that I pinpoint from a couple of years before this film, before Lorna, where I thought that's the one, maybe a really heavy duty Jess Franco fanatic or someone more versed in his filmography would be able to pinpoint another film or spot another film, or they wouldn't. I don't know. But that's the film where I've always felt like, that seems to me like where it really kind of ground together.
Mm.
At least for me. I'm sure others would say, no, female vampire. But, you know, female vampire, you've got to crack the smelling salts under my nose to get me to fucking watch the rest of it. So I'm really impressed. Let me say it up front. I'm really impressed with Lorna the Exorcist. Outside of the crappy title, Lorna the Exorcist. I would have felt better if the movie were just called Lorna.
Yeah, well, we've talked about, that during the course of this Nashie cast, because of the films we've done in the 70s, we're continually running across really lame attempts to try and tie it into the Exorcist craze of the early 70s. Yes, this is one of the lamest, it's totally preposterous.
Yeah.
I mean, unless Exorcist has some other word that I'm not aware of, it's like...
Well, there's no other connotation to Exorcist that I'm
aware of. Not me either, and it's totally... But that was purely, obviously, there to pull in the Exorcist crowd, but it's a completely...
Well, and you can tell that from all the various and sundry other titles that this film is known under. I mean... Okay, there are two French titles listed, and the English translation would be The Possessed of the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Exorcism, which was kind of an international title, apparently. And then The Devil's Possessed, or The Possessed of the Demon.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Linda, which was apparently a USA title at some point. And then Lorna the Exorcist, and then Lorna... Yeah, Lorna L'Extrasis, another French title.
French, yeah.
And then in Italy, it was known as Sexy Diabolic Story, which...
who can deny that? I mean, that's... Yeah,
yeah, I mean, you know.
That's what it is, I guess, if you're going
to... But out of all those titles, unlike any of them.
Yeah, none of them are really good. I think you're right. Lorna would have been...
Lorna would have been...
But then, of course, in those days, especially of exploitation, someone would immediately said, nobody's going to know that's a horror movie, or no one's going to know...
Yeah,
but really, it might have pulled in just as many people thinking that it's an erotic film because it's as much that as it is horror. I mean, it's as much a.
Oh, very, very, very easily.
But basically, the translation of maybe like this like possession of the demon or something. But that makes it sound more horror than it really is. I mean, it makes it sound doesn't bring across the subtlety of the story, or it makes it sound more exaggerated. So. But yeah, Lorna the Exorcist is a pretty ridiculous title, I gotta say.
When I was making notes and when I was thinking about the movie, I was just always thinking of it as Lorna, because that just seems the perfect title for it. But let's...
I want to delve into...
Let's rattle off what this film is. A one-sentence statement of it would be a modern-day or early... early to mid-70s. Let's just say this. A contemporary retelling... with a twist of the Faust legend.
Yeah.
That would be the way, kind of one sentence, toss it out there and give you an idea of what it is, kind of description. Essentially, it's the story of one man, his family, and the bargain that he made years before for great wealth coming back to finally bite him in the ass. It's essentially a deal with the devil story. And in this fellow's case, his devil is named Lorna. Would you think that would be a good description of it?
Sure. I think that was very good. Yeah, that was very good as far as your basic line here.
That's what it is. As the film begins, we're not aware of anything of this nature. What we're aware of is that this obviously wealthy man has come home from a business trip. His young daughter, played by Lena Romay, is very excited for her dad to come home because her birthday is in a few days. She's about to turn 18. And he seems... And I love this, the first part of the film... He's getting these phone calls, and at first we're not privy to why he's getting these phone calls and why these phone calls are upsetting him. And the impression that we were getting right off the bat is I thought, okay, yeah, and apparently his wife is aware of this as well, that surely these must be phone calls from a mistress or a girlfriend that he's just, got on the side and that his wife knows about but, doesn't rock the boat. There's an understanding between the two of them for whatever reason.
Yeah, because for the first part of the film, for quite a while into the film at least, the wife seems very, very... I mean, you're like, she's either stupid or she's just like really, like you said, not wanting to upset the apple cart here.
Right.
Basically, like just kind of taking him, and you figure like, she can't be that dumb. So she's probably like, just when he tells her like, oh, it's nothing, she just doesn't push it, doesn't push the issue.
You essentially have four main characters in this film. You have the husband, the wife, the teenage girl, Lena Romay's character, and you have Lorna. Now, there are a couple of other characters, but they're very minor.
Yeah.
Let's start with the actors. We've talked about Lena Romay. The gentleman playing her father, Guy Delorme, or Guy Delorme.
Yeah.
Since he's French, I'm assuming that would be the way it was pronounced. He's a very good actor. I was very impressed with him. And he had to convey it. He had to convey a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I think he did it very well. And I think when you realize how good he is, it's not a big shock that he had a career that he had. The ability he shows to get across conflicting emotions in several different scenes is very neat. And Franco, and I don't mean this as a criticism of Franco. Franco, in at least a couple of instances, puts him in a really bad spot for an actor.
Yeah, right.
Where any normal director would have decided, you know, this scene doesn't need to be in the movie because all I'm doing is showing him go from one place to another.
Right.
Where it seems later, about midway through the film, where he's following Lorna from one place to another, where she's kind of demanding his presence. And they're extended scenes, and they would feel, and sometimes do feel, like padding. But he has to, as an actor, carry the scene because Lorna herself is just kind of being mysterious at this point because you're not aware of what the hell is going on with her character.
Right.
And he does an exceptional job of being your focal point and keeping you interested in a scene that really shouldn't be as interesting as it is, because all you're doing is watching this guy leave a hotel, get into a car, drive to another location, or be driven to another location, go up the stairs and go into this apartment where Lorna lives at this in this resort town. And it shouldn't be as compelling as it is, and it's compelling because of him and because of some choices that Franco makes as a director. But there are times when I was thinking, wow, he's really hanging this poor fucker out to dry. Because if he were the least bit less cinematically endowed as an actor, let's put it that way, if he could not communicate as effectively without dialogue as he's able to, they'd be internal. These scenes would just drive you crazy. Now, there are scenes in the movie that do drive me crazy, and we'll get to that.
Yes. There
but okay, here's
but a, no, you're right. I mean, he's no, I thought he was very good. I thought the whole cast was, I mean, really was pretty good in this film. You know, I thought it was really, you know, really good actors.
Pamela Stanford, who plays the mother, I think is not only...
No, I thought she was... Isn't she Lorna? Or I
oh, God, she was Lorna. Right. Okay, yeah, she's Lorna, and she's very good, but she has to play a kind of mysterious kind of character who essentially, let's admit, is a supernatural character. By the end of it, she really kind of is. What'd you think of the psycho eye makeup that they have her wearing
throughout? Yeah, let's talk about the eye makeup, because it's sort of the elephant in the... I mean, you can't not talk about
it.
Okay, obviously, well, needless to say, we know there's a reason for it. And somewhere in Franco's twisted brain, we know that this is not an accident, because nobody else in the film looks like this. There is a reason for doing it. I'm wondering if... See, okay, let me first say that... Did you ever... I don't know if what you... You know, it never really makes it clear. Because I don't necessarily think that she's supposed to be the devil.
No.
Or even satanic, necessarily. I think, actually kind of had a feeling. And here's something that I've noticed in the film. Did you notice all the... Well, some of it you can't help but noticing some of it's right. But did you notice that the continual marine imagery, marine life imagery, sea life imagery throughout the film?
Yes.
You know, the place where she stays, he recognizes it because it has a lobster on, you know, has lobster as the sign out there. There's just a lobster.
Well, the town she met. Okay, first.
The whole town that they're in. Yeah,
hold on for a second. Yes. Let's make sure people understand this. When the film begins, you're introduced to the family. There seems to be a problem where the father slash husband is getting phone calls from someone who is demanding that he do something in particular. He is arguing with this person, not wanting to do it, but he finally gives in. And what she wants him to do, what this person on the other end of the phone wants him to do, is to bring his family, instead of to the vacation that they want to go on because of the daughter's turning 18 and a celebration of her birthday, she demands that instead he and the family come to this seaside resort town at this time of year when the place is really kind of emptied out because it's the wrong time of year. It's colder weather and it's not a place that people tend to go during this time of year. She demands that they come there. There, she confronts him, demands that he keep his part of the bargain that they made 18 years before, which was that he was broke. They met over a gambling table. She said, I can give you all the wealth you want. I just want one thing. And, of course, that one thing is your firstborn.
Yeah.
And your firstborn daughter. That's your firstborn daughter. And
when she turns 18.
When she turns 18, she's mine.
Yeah.
He foolishly went along with this.
It's one of those sound like a good idea at the time kind of thing.
Exactly. And 18 years later, you're scratching your head going, I don't know that I actually believed this shit.
Yeah.
But that is the... That's the crux of the problem. That's the storyline, and it's, will he be able to somehow not turn his daughter over to this woman?
Yeah.
Does this woman really have any power to force him to do what she wants him to do?
Mm-hmm.
And does giving you that broad outline, or even a little bit more detailed outline of the story of this film, kind of undercut what the movie accomplishes?
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I think it does, but at the same time, if we're going to talk a little about the movie, a little bit about the movie, we kind of got to lay some of that plot line out. So, with that in mind, and what you're talking about, the whole repeated maritime images, she appears to live in this seaside town.
Right,
You know, so it's almost as if the reason they have to come to her is that she's not going to get too far from the sea.
See, I'm feeling like she's supposed to be, you know, and I don't know, you know, with Franco, you know, of course, is well-read and is into so many stuff. He could, you know, I think he's pulling on some sort of sea mythology.
Yeah.
Because even a little, okay, now obviously there's the whole crabs thing, which is, you know, just mind-blowing.
Which is another key thing that kind of plays into that.
Yeah, right. But even in the scene where Howard Vernon, dear old Howard Vernon, this movie is anything is proof that Howard Vernon was a guy that Franco was like, dude, I need somebody to just step into this role. Are you free?
If you got a day or two.
Because talk about this will not go on Howard. This will not be like one of your top five favorite Howard Vernon roles.
He doesn't even have a lot of dialogue.
No, he's basically just Lorna's henchman. He has two scenes. But when he comes out, and there's a scene where he comes out and strikes the father, strikes Patrick, with what? What is he used to beat him with?
He picks up a conch shell.
So I think they're supposed to me, either resemble shells, make you think of shells, the way they go in as, you know, or that it may actually be drawing on some type of art from particular culture's art of how they depicted maybe sea gods. I mean, like I said, I'm really stretching here, but I thought of mermaids. Maybe. So what I'm getting at here is, you know, we know there's a reason for it. I don't like it. I think it was a bad choice, personally.
Really?
I think it was a poor choice. Now, I got used to it. I mean, after watching the film like three times, I mean, you know, and I think she's beautiful actress, and I think she does great in the role. I got used to it, and I knew that, you know, this isn't just clumsy makeup, or there is a reason for this. So it made me think about why he would do this. Personally, I didn't like it. I guess one thing is maybe I would have liked it more if maybe, you know, it had been a little more clear who she was, what, you know, without even, you know, it doesn't have to like just totally spell out every detail, but maybe if it had made it a little more clear, you know, because I'm looking at all this sea time, I'm like, okay, maybe I'm just grasping at straws there too, but I think there is something there. I think that there's a reason why he hits him with a conch shell, you know. So like I said, there's a reason for the makeup. I personally, it bothered me. I didn't, and I know a lot of people wouldn't, and like I said, I tried to work with it, and eventually I came out the day saying, like, I think it still would have been, you know, I've kind of wondered, like, you know, if even only he and only his family, only he and Linda, or like, does everybody see her this way, or is it just he sees her? That's how she appears to him because she's revealing who she is, and maybe everybody else might not even see her that way. Is he, like, seeing her
true
self?
That's an interesting idea. It's not one that the film plays with.
No.
Because in the film, it's just that she wears outrageous makeup.
Yeah.
And, well, nobody ever talks about the outrageous makeup in the film, and it's just taken as a given. This is... I agree with you. I didn't particularly like it either. It didn't bother me because at first, until Howard Vernon punches him with the shell, which immediately makes you think, God, what a weird fucking choice.
I know, exactly. Yeah,
it's only then that certain things start to click.
Yeah, he's like, wait a minute. You start to realize
so
that it's continuing.
From there on, I honestly thought, my interpretation is that she's not the devil or a demon or anything like that. She is an evil supernatural creature, and in my opinion, looking back at the kind of mythology of mermaid, I think she was a mermaid.
Well, you notice there's in the scene where she's making love with Patrick, where they're making the pact in the first place, where she first meets him, you know, she says something like, because I'm sterile, and she says something to the effect of, as women, it's something like, this, it was my kind of, as women of my type, or something, as we are. And so that made me think of her as basically from some race of, you know, some like type of, you know, which is an interesting thing. Yeah.
So that's what I took it as. That's what clicked in my head is that she's a mermaid.
No. Yeah. Well, and I definitely thought mermaid at some point. No.
The movie doesn't spell it out, and that's one of the really things
doesn't.
About
it really doesn't. Yeah.
But there are so many nautical things, many things that relate directly to the sea and the ocean that it just seemed to me to be something he was trying to be obliquely clear about. If that's even a phrase.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
God. Mark it down, people. I just made up a phrase. Clear.
Yeah, you did. You know.
Obliquely clear. Trademark. That one's mine.
Yeah, we'll throw that in there with entertainable and all.
I am entertainable. Jesus. All right. So I agree with you. I think that the eye makeup is distracting, but and I would have, I wish it had been less.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. Yeah. But at the same time, when you start thinking about what it seems to represent or what it's attempting to get across to the viewer, I like your idea of that being there, but only through his eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that would be nice because then it would be the kind of thing that's only being seen by someone under her influence. And I think that would be kind of nice. Yeah. But that's not done in the film. That's interesting.
There's a pact I have to propose to you. Very soon you will be acquiring a large fortune. And finally find your happiness, too. But on one condition.
I don't believe in heaven or hell. I don't believe in pacts with the devil. Faust was just the fruit of an author's imagination.
But today you were a heavy money winner, weren't you, at the casino? Thanks to what? Thanks to me.
That's a fact.
Yes, a fact, but offered as proof of my powers.
All right, go on.
You make love to me now, and since I'm sterile, as women all are who arrive here out of the darkness, you will enjoy it as never before. And after, you'll leave this bed, full of desire to return to that pitiful hotel and your wife who's expecting you, always full of hope. Upon arriving, make love to her. You must do it immediately. In 9 months, a daughter will be born, a lovely child. The infant is mine, but you'll raise her until she turns 18 when I can come for her as agreed, and she'll be mine.
You don't make much sense.
Understanding me isn't important. If you accept, then, in 30 days, you'll already be immensely rich. A fortune for a child who doesn't exist at the moment, who isn't born yet. Do you accept it?
I've got to have you.
Do you accept it?
I accept.
There are a number of things in the movie that I love, and I got to tell you, overall, I really did enjoy the film. I do think it's great.
Yeah.
I want to talk quickly about a few things that I didn't like. Besides thinking that the makeup on Pamela was a little much.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the fact that this wonderful DVD is a reconstruction of essentially the perfect version of the film, and therefore it's about 100 minutes long. It's an hour 40 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, it's too long.
Agreed.
It needs to be just probably about 10 minutes shorter, in my opinion. And to me, the thing that most obviously need to be trimmed, besides some of the stuff that you could argue, there's some things that I would argue should be trimmed down because it's excessive, but that I can see holding on to because it sets the mood. It's showing you this kind of alien looking landscape of this seaside resort, but there's a little too much of that. But what I really think ought to be trimmed out is a completely unnecessary little subplot that just kind of adds about 8 to 10 minutes of worthless footage, and I think that would be the way to trim. And that's the completely unconnected thing that has to do with this other woman who was apparently a victim of Lorna, who is in an insane asylum. Jess Franco plays her doctor.
Oh, by the way, let me point out here, if you're ever put in an insane asylum and your doctor turns out to be Jess Franco, it's probably not a good. No, it's probably not going to be a real productive. not going to be a time of healing.
No. You may actually get to have sex, but you know your life is probably near its end. Yeah. So, yeah.
Apparently, you don't get to have pants in this asylum. You know, that's or underwear. Even that's always thought out. I'd love to know what this health facility is where the inmates just basically wear unbuttoned shirts around everywhere, and that's it. And that's all you get. You know, and stockings. Of course, you get black stockings. Naturally, they'll give you black stuff. But that's
black stockings are a given, of course. But maybe they just don't have the money to afford a full wardrobe. We don't have underwear. I'm sorry, there's no underwear. But here's a shirt and some socks of a type. So that whole subplot where we watch this character, we come back to her three or four times throughout the movie. And watch her writhe around in either agony or pleasure, depending on what is actually happening to her, kind of in a room all by herself. It's unnecessary, boring, and pointless. I know why it's there. He's trying to get across the impression that this is something that Lorna has done before and will do again, essentially setting up a continuity across time. But it's unnecessary.
I actually have a different way of approaching it. I agree with you. I didn't like it. It's one of the problems I had. One of the things I did not like about the film. Of course, each time you watch it, because you're forced to see it anyway, you start thinking about, you know, what does this mean? Is this just, and the worst case scenario, it's just padding, you know, it's just filler.
That's all it is.
And I started trying to play around with it and think about, I started thinking for a while that it was supposed to be that it's not actually happening simultaneously with what else is, like, I know when you watch it on face value,
when
you watch it on face value, you think, like, this is a woman that Lorna's already done this. This is somebody's life she's already done this to. And while she's screwing around with Patrick, you know, this woman is at her tail end where she's just about been destroyed by Lorna. So this is like the tail end of this particular relationship Lorna's had.
Yeah.
It's going on. Okay. I started thinking of a different way. I if this is supposed to be in the future and this is Linda. This is Linda as a full adult, where she's basically at the end of her
Lena Romay's character.
Lena Romay's character. Okay, the reason that didn't ultimately work, and of course we don't want to spoil too much about this film, because I can't really tell what happens at the end. Let's just say that basically the way the film unfolds and ends doesn't make that work. So then I started thinking another idea. I started thinking, what if this is in the future and this is actually Linda, who is kind of continuing what Lorna started, and this is somebody that not the woman is not Linda, but in other words, remember when
she's the one
when she, because when she's seen, there's one point in the film where she's visited by Lorna and she sees her as Linda, as she sees her as, and I'm totally thinking, like, this is maybe supposed to be in the future, that this is like who Linda has done this to, carrying on Lorna's, you know, continuing evil. Her magic or her particular evil that she's done so in the future. Either way, it still didn't make it really.
It doesn't
work for me. Yeah. It made it a little more interesting to me to think if that's what Franco's trying to make you try and figure out or try and guess at. Or was it just plain filler? And if and I agree with you that it could have totally gone away and wouldn't have, you know, affected anything in the story.
It serves no really good purpose. There's nothing in it that we don't get elsewhere in the story better.
Right.
Much better, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the scenes that I'm going to start talking about. The scenes that I think were most effective.
Okay.
First of all, or just aspects of the film that I think are most effective. Starting with, I think that the use of music, as is usual with Jess Franco, is very good here.
It is. I like the music in it.
It's a wonderful score. It fits. It enhances. It emphasizes correctly certain emotions and certain. Let's just say atmospherics. It works extremely well with the setting, this odd semi-deserted seaside resort with kind of futuristic architecture, which gives everything a kind of alien landscape feel at times. Very nice. Really enjoyed it. We've talked about the performances, but let's move into some of the things that some of these actors are asked to do. Jacqueline Laurent playing the mother / wife. Marianne is asked to do something absolutely hideous. Sexual in nature, but there is a scene.
It's a scene that a lot of actresses would consider incredibly demeaning in a lot of ways, and just too over
horrifying.
Where
the in a scene that can really only be, it's yet another one of those things that points you toward the kind of nautical maritime themes of the horrors visited upon people or the terrible things that are related to the Lorna character. At one point, Marianne, the Lena Romay's character's mother, is struck with an illness that has her bedridden, and crabs seem to emerge from her vagina. And real crabs, actual, like,
We're not talking about
venereal disease. We're not talking a minuscule infestation. We're talking about actual sea creatures emanating from her groin. And it's a really bizarre, I mean, it's the kind of sequence you're never going to forget once you've seen it. And what I find amazing is that it's not as if you actively see a crab emerge from between her legs. It's completely implied, and the horror of it is gotten across by the actors in the scene, and the realization of what you're seeing is that much more horrific because of it. It's impressive. Like I said, you're never going to forget it.
No. It's like it's like the big black phallus, you know, the big black dildo in Virgin Among the Living Dead. It's just one of those. It's one of those Franco moments where you're just like, what in the hell? But even that had a, you know, as somebody pointed out to us later in one of our listeners, you know, that it had it was referenced somewhere else in that film that set it up. So even that had a purpose, just like this. It just ties back into other things you've seen in the film. But but it's totally just mind blowing. It's one of those things where you just like shake your head and just say like, wow.
I know. And here's the thing is, one of the things that seems to be true of a number of Jess Franco films, especially the pulpy ones, the horror ones from the 70s that kind of have a pulpish tone to them, is that they seem to be influenced by the rather erotically horrific Italian comics known as fumetti. At least I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's probably right.
If you've ever seen any of those, folks, if you've never visited the site called The Groovy Age of Horror, there's a great guy who runs a website, and he has a couple of collaborators on there who handle different things. My buddy Brian Lindsay does Doc Savage novel reviews on there. And there's another guy who does fumetti reviews, where he gets his hands on, he has apparently a huge collection of Italian fumetti comics. And these things are completely adult / X-rated comic books, hideous things, hideous in that they're horror stories, and they're hideously horrific, black and white comic books. From I want to say the 60s and 70s, probably up through the 80s. I'm not sure if they're still being produced. But they're incredibly gory and sexually explicit and horrendous, often with images and things in it that you're absolutely appalled exist. And that moment with the crabs coming out of this woman's vagina, honestly, that's the moment where I went, holy God, okay, that's like something out of one of those crazy-ass fumettis. that seems to be one of the influences on that aspect, at least that part or that scene of the film. And I have to say it was kind of nice to have that backed up by some of the talking heads, some of the folks on the extras of this DVD, where they actually mentioned the fumetti influence, and I was like, yeah, no joke, man. that crab thing is sick as hell. So there's that scene, which I found absolutely fascinating. The ending I'll leave alone, which I found torturously fascinating too, and strangely effective and affecting. And I think the other things that I found really intriguing in it, and I guess we're going to have to, I kind of want to dance around the particulars of it, but the scene where Lorna finally is in the room with Linda, that is Lena Romay's character,
right.
Where you have a series of things that happen in that scene that become progressively more horrific.
Yes.
And not the least of which is Lorna has continued to call the Linda character her daughter. You're given the impression that without Lorna's intervention, they would never have had this child, which is why she feels that she has the right to claim her.
Right.
So The moments when they're in the room and she starts treating Linda as if she were a child and having her suck at her breast and things of this nature, it's really bizarre because And I think that he was obviously going for this. There's a combination of eroticism,
yeah,
and kind of sexual. Well, how best to put this?
Yeah,
it's a combination of being titillated and being repulsed,
sure,
simultaneous.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, because and so many levels because the way the story is in tow, like. You're thinking, you know, you're saying like, yeah, this scene is incestuous, but in other ways, it's not. You know, in other ways, like you can't because of the ambiguities of the relationship between the two of them.
Right.
And so you're like, yeah, it's like your mind's like, you know, you're watching, you're like, you know, this scene is just all kinds of wrong in so many ways, you know, and yet it's fascinating and just kind of just you're not. You, I mean, you're just like, where is this thing going? And it's mesmerizing. It really is. But
mesmerizing
is a word because you can't look at. You know, it's one of those things like. You know, it's like, boy, this is just a really, this is sick stuff, and, you know, and I can't look away, you know. It's like,
well, it's true. It's like, here's the thing. I do not consider this one of my favorite Jess Franco films, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I do consider it a good Jess Franco mm-hmm. film. I have to admit that there are at least four things I am never, ever, ever going to forget from this film.
Yeah.
I'm never going to forget the crab scene.
Right.
I'm never going to forget the scene that we're talking about right now between Lorna and Linda.
Right.
I'm never going to forget the creepy atmospherics of that that city. I mean, yeah. that beachside town with the weird kind of alien-looking architecture.
It does. It's like, maybe one of the essays or one of the extras on the DVD, but somebody refers to it as like looking like it's, I mean, like they basically looks like something out of science fiction, you know. And so the cinematography really comes through in those scenes. Very well known.
And strangely enough, the other thing I'm never going to forget is Howard Vernon punching the dude with the shell.
Yeah.
I cannot get that image out of my head. Because it's like, holy shit, there's Howard Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
His name was in the credits. Here he is.
And here he is. And he just
punches this dude with the shell. That's weird.
There was Howard Vernon, ladies and gentlemen. You know, and I hope you enjoyed
everybody
it.
Everybody applause.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like Udo Kier's scene in Suspiria. There's Udo Kier, folks.
Yeah.
Everybody,
don't blink or you'll miss him. Yeah, I know.
Everybody applaud. Yep, giving dialogue that wasn't even necessary. There we go. All right, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Kier.
you'll be signing copies of that DVD for your years now. You know, and you.
But that jeez, those four things I can't get out of my head from this film.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to be able to say that the final scene of the movie is that way, but honestly, as good as I think that final scene is, it didn't have the impact on me as the four mm-hmm. things I'm talking about. Those are the things mm-hmm. that just stuck in my mm-hmm. head, and I don't think they'll ever come out of it.
Okay.
Strangely enough, you know, the two images that I remember from Jess Franco's Jack the Ripper that'll stay with me forever.
Yeah.
The look on Klaus Kinski's face as he's going about his business, just because Klaus Kinski just stays in your memory no matter what.
Oh yeah.
And the sight of Lena Romay, who's a kind of a dancer in a music hall, doing her little can-can style dance, and then turning around and flipping up her skirt so that you can see the long underwear, really frilly stuff.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Those are the two images out of his Jack the Ripper that I can't get out of my head. It's like I still like a Jack the Ripper film. It is nowhere near anything like the real Jack the Ripper case.
No, yeah,
but
no.
That's what's weird about that movie is those are the two images I've never gotten out of my head. Is the, you know, Klaus Kinski, which you would expect.
Yeah.
And just the sight of that really cute thing where she turns around and flips the thing up and you see the frilly underwear. It's just like, it's not even erotic. It's just silly. Yeah. That's all I can remember.
Okay.
What are the things, what were your carryaways? What did you take out of it?
I'll say this. I like the film. I don't think I don't get the impression I liked it as much as you did.
Oh, okay, really?
I did like it. I do think it's a, like you said, I think it's a good film. Now, I agree with you that I would not put this as towards the top of Franco's films.
Right.
You know, and of course, I haven't seen near as many of his films as you have, but in this last year, I've been watching more of them. I've probably seen now probably a good 15, 16 of his films now, you know.
Okay.
And I wouldn't put it towards the top tier. I think you could definitely, I think you could use this film as an introduction to Franco because I think it's very much, I mean, it says a lot. It says a lot about him. I mean, I think you could, if you wanted to show someone a film that's just like, this is why Jess Franco you know, has his following, his reputation. Yeah. This is why his stuff is unlike anything else. I think you could show him this film. A lot of things I like about the film. I think Lena Romay is terrific in it. I mean, it's she does some incredible subtle segues. You know, she's called on, like we talked about, these actors being called on to do a lot of things. You know, she's called on to extend scenes and play out scenes that most sane directors would have called cut 2 minutes ago. But she's called on to do, and she is very game about it. You know, she manages to keep it going, and she, you know, keep her character going. I think that you know, again, we talk about her playing her age, but you know, when she's playing Linda as this kind of, you know, just as a kind of happy-go-lucky, slightly spoiled kid. Yeah. She's managed to do that. Then the scenes where she kind of goes through a transition where she's, you know, I mean, that's very subtle, very well played. The first time we see her where she's changed after she's met Lorna, you know, it's mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really, she doesn't, you know, doesn't overplay the hand, you know, it's just a very understated kind of thing she does that suddenly makes her look like she's, you know, like she's suddenly, you know, not the same person anymore, you know, like she, you know, right. It's really nice. So she's great in it. I think there's a lot of really neat little things with the family that are very touching, that are kind of neat little. I love this. I love, some people would find it silly. I love the scene where they dance together. I think it's fantastic.
Oh, really?
I just
cracked. It's a scene that could have been saved or made better with just a couple of extra shots.
Well, it's silly.
Close-ups of them.
Well, it's silly in the sense that they do it for such a short. They do it for like, they dance for like 15 seconds and then it's over, you know. But, you know, to me, it kind of made me smile, and it actually kind of made them seem like a family that they did that together. And I thought that was a neat little human touch in this bizarre film. You know, I thought it was kind of, and just some of the other little interactions between father and daughter. I mean, they really have a nice little chemistry together. That she,
well, I agree.
Makes, you know,
and that was a weird thing is not so much with the mother, which I mean, that's, I don't want this to sound like a criticism of that actress. But the interactions, you're right. I think the interactions between the actor playing the father and Lena. Mm-hmm. Well, between was it Guy Delorme and Lena Romay, really that really did feel like a father daughter relationship, which was really kind of neat. And it has to play into the effectiveness of the movie, because he is trying everything in the world. Once he realizes he's not going to be able to get out of this, he's tortured. By the fact that he realizes, I'm going to lose my daughter and I can't do anything about it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. That was surprisingly effective.
Yeah, on a comic, one of the things that kind of amused me about the film is the scene where when it shows Lorna and Patrick, you know, where they seal the pact, you know, by having sex, and just the whole time she's kind of laying out this pact for him, and he's just basically dying to get at her body, and it's like it's one of those things you look at, just like, yeah, men truly will believe anything you say to them as long as they can get to the, you know,
as long
he's
as
just
they get
like
laid,
he's just like yeah, come on, let me
yeah, whatever, whatever, whatever. Yeah, right.
But no, seriously, I do, like I said, there's a lot of things I like about the film. Where I think the film, like, I'll just go ahead and say, you know, for me, well, let me ask you this. You know, they talk about Jess Franco's films, a lot of them kind of being in segment, in like...
Oh, they're being different periods.
To me, would you say that this fits in kind of with the Virgin Among the Living Dead type film, dreamlike and that kind of...
Definitely,
like that type of Jess Franco film.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I like Virgin Among the Living Dead, I think, a lot more, I think, than this.
Oh, well, I do,
you know,
too.
I think that, like, I gave it a 6. And I think what kept it from being, I think honestly, it could easily be made a solid 7 if it was just trimmed of some of the excess that, even though I kind of had fun trying to figure out some of the things that whole subplot with the girl in the insane asylum, man, I mean, really that could easily go away. And I think that some scenes are undermined by literally the director just going on a little too far with them, you know, going on not too far in extremity, but I mean, as far as just
length.
Length. I mean, like, yeah. I just felt like there were just times when I felt like, you know, I was in that scene and I just grew restless. And one of the things, we're not going to give anything away, I'm not going to spoil it, but going to the ending, you know, it's like, my feeling is the ending, there was a point that it could have ended and it would have been a really effective ending, and I think
it went on a little too long.
It did, and she's very, Lena Romay's very good in the scene, but I really think
she's
terrific
it,
because
she
she's
sells
like,
every
she's,
bit of
she's
it.
Like, he's not going to say cut, so I'm going for it, and she does, but if it ended, you know, I'm not going to say where, but you probably know where I'm talking about. But the point where it ended, it would have been like, yeah, that's really chilling and really effective. It's just like, oh, man, it's just too much. So, like I said, not enough to make it a bad, like I said, a good film, but I really felt like it kept it from being a film I can really feel fond of or really feel like I could, you know, that I could see myself going back to a lot, you know. So it just didn't quite, I just felt like some of that excess needed to be trimmed. That's the problems that I I have with it. But there's a lot to like in the film. There really is.
That's interesting. The original rating I wrote down for it was a 6 as well.
Was it?
But it was going back through it again and realizing how much of it was sticking with me and how effectively it was sticking with me and how many things it had me thinking about days after the fact. I went back and I changed it to a 7. It's not in my top five. That's something I was going to talk about and kind of forgot until now. Robert Monell, who does the amazing, he's a great writer. He does that wonderful blog called "I'm in a Jess Franco State of Mind." I went and read his take on the film, and he loved it. He actually thinks it's one of Franco's 5 best films.
Well, apparently a lot of people do. I mean, and that's kind of how they touted on the DVD release, is like one of his best. I know a lot of people feel that way about it.
See, I can't go that far.
Yeah.
I would definitely. I will say this. I would put it in the top 15 for Franco. It would definitely end up in a top 15 for me because there are a lot of his films that I just completely discount because I can't think of them as good.
Yeah. Some of them are actually just torture to...
There are some that I just don't think are worth worrying with.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them. I'm glad I've seen them. I'm glad I've seen them because they, you know, it gives me another facet to his filmography. It gives me another look inside his psyche.
Uh-huh.
But I don't want to see it again.
Right.
It doesn't hold anything for me.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's why, as you can demonstrate, I have a lot of respect for Robert Monell and his opinion. But the thing about Jess Franco's films, especially once you've watched a lot of them, is how incredibly subjective your reactions to them have to be.
Yeah,
film cannot be an objective thing that you talk about. It's always opinion. It's always emotional. Yes, yeah. It's always something that you have to deal with on that level.
Yeah.
How it affected you.
Yeah.
Did it do something to you? Mm-hmm. So, in that respect, I can understand if this was one of someone's favorite Jess Franco films.
Because you can't watch it without being affected by it. I mean, you can't watch it without being, you know, just going through a lot of waves of, you know, you definitely react to this film, you know. It's too much going on and too many things that are just too subversive and too just, you know, unusual and striking, like you said. I mean, and I agree with that. I mean, it was a film that I still, you know, even on repeated viewings, you know, you just, those same emotions come out again, you know, just like you said, revulsion and fascination. And so, yeah.
Well, and the thing is, for me, I mean, it's Virgin Among the Living Dead is, I think, several strides better than this. I don't have the feeling with that movie that it needed to be trimmed.
Right, same way.
It felt like it was the right length.
Yeah.
It felt like every piece fit, and it didn't feel like there was any padding.
Yeah.
Of course, in that respect, what we're watching is a reconstruction of a full-length cut of the film that maybe, you know, somebody would have sat down and gone, you know, this piece doesn't, I mean, it really should have.
Here they are trying to give us everything, you know. Their point was to give you everything.
And thank God for that.
Oh, sure. Hey, listen,
I'll praise Mondo Macabro and their DVD.
This DVD is fantastic. I mean, I would love to see this kind of care given to every film because it's I love the fact. Yeah, and I'm sure that their idea is we're going to give you everything we found in this film as much as we can. So yeah, so they wouldn't, you know, it's like they obviously they're not gonna do an edit on it or think like they're just like here it is, and
thank God.
No, it's great, and I think we I have no problems with the fact that we picked this one as our Lynn and Ramey tribute because regardless of whatever else you think about the film, you know, I think it's a great showcase for her. Not just physically, you know, but I mean, she is just her acting skills. I think she's very good in this. So I think it was perfect. You know, I have no problem with the fact that this was our Lynn and Ramey tribute. I think it's, you know, worthy of that.
As I look back at his films, I don't think I would use it as an introductory film for him.
Mm-hmm.
I still always default to Awful Dr. Orloff or The Diabolical Dr. Z.
No, I can see that.
Because they're much more...
it is kind of good for people to see where he started with making more kind of conventional thrillers, even though they still had his kind of, you know, perverse taste on it and all, but still like kind of we started with this, you know, before he really... Yeah, that's true. It's a good... Yeah, I can see that as a good beginning.
You know, I could definitely see this, you know, if somebody got into those two films saying,
show me some more extreme stuff. Show me like he really, you know, why people talk about him being such a, you know, why he's so polarizing, you know. You could show like...
It's like, you drop this in their lap and then there you go.
Yeah, it's like, because a lot of people would be leaving the room and doing some of this stuff here, you know, exactly, we'd not be able to take it. So.
I'm glad we did this film as well.
Yeah.
The strange thing to me is that what this reminds me of, and it's something that I thought about. I don't think we talked about it in the podcast, but it's something that reminds me that there was this thought in my head that it would be easily possible for us to do a podcast just on Jess Franco films forever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And explore his films because even the real experts on Jess Franco out there, like Robert Monell, like Tim Lucas, like people who have devoted a lot of time to going through his movies, even they, I think, going through his work at different times in your life, you're going to find different things.
I recently
was talking about The Wild Bunch and about how when I was younger, the movie The Wild Bunch appealed to me because it's incredibly violent and it's extremely exciting and it's this male bonding story. And then as I got older, it appealed to me on a different level because as you get older, you start to see themes within it and what these guys are talking about. And it's not just these, you know, these guys talking about different things in a humorous way. It's these guys talking about serious subjects. And that seems to me that it's something that could be talked. You could see that in Jess Franco movies as well. Whereas, for instance, if I were younger, I would watch this film and maybe see it, you know, as kind of really disgusting and titillating and this and the other. But then as you get older, maybe you're looking at it and going, and you're seeing the conflict of the father and husband going, oh my God, what the fuck have I done to get this family, to get this child, to become, you know, monetarily well off, I have essentially gutted myself.
Because Lord, you could make a whole, you could write about the whole film as just the father having to face his daughter losing her virginity and becoming a woman. You know, I mean, there's a fear of. I mean, you could go off in that whole other tangent with that. You know?
You can read it as, you know, fear of a parent's fear of a child's sexuality and things of that nature, because that's definitely spelled out visually in at least one scene.
In more than one scene.
And there's a flesh crawling aspect of that's really quite nice. I'm glad that we covered this film, and I'm glad that you liked it, because I kind of thought that you would. I was surprised by my own reaction to it, because I was fearful that there had been so much built up around it.
As like this one great, of his best.
This great film that he, you know, da 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 da. But no, I think on the whole, it kind of proved itself to be worthy of the attention.
It was definitely worth seeing. That's what I'll say about it. I could definitely recommend it so much. This is definitely a film worth seeing. So,
all right, cool. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back, go through a few emails, and then we'll get the hell out of here.
All righty.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Downplays is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Downplace can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Downplace, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
All right, it is time to dive into the mailbag here on 31.5, episode 31.5.
Got your harness secure. I'll start lowering you down into the vast, vast, cavernous mailbag here.
Yeah, it does make a hideously bad sound when you lower me down into this thing. Okay, let's see. We got a few things to talk about here. We got an email from our beloved Elena, the mistress of Horror Rises from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote to us after the last episode and said, "Hey guys, yesterday I saw Los Cantabros. I like it, but not too much. I almost fell asleep." I have to admit.
You're studying too hard there, Elena.
May well be. I have to admit that I am not a big fan of Peplum, so anyway, the beginning with the comical characters and also with the introduction with the voiceover reminded me of a series of comic books that were very famous in Europe when I was a kid. They're called Asterix and Obelix. I do not know if you're familiar with them, as you can, and then she provides a link to the Wikipedia page for Asterix. And as you can see, there is a little parallelism here. And just to stop, I'd say, yes, I know about the, I think we both know about the Asterix comics.
I can't say I've seen those for years. I've never actually like looked at one, read one, but I mean, I've always seen them. I always wondered, what are those? I had no idea that they originated in, I didn't know they were Spanish, or just Europe, I guess.
I think they're French.
But I always really,
I think it's Asterix the Gaul.
Okay. Oh, they're right. Okay.
Okay, I'm pretty sure anyway.
But yeah, I've always been interested in those, wondering what those are like.
Well, I remember we had several of them, several of the English translations on the shelf when I used to work in bookstores, and so you end up, you know, because you just be able to just pull them off the shelf and read them, and I remember reading them and really enjoying the ones they did. There's a lot of them, so
I got that impression that there was a whole bunch of
I never delved completely into them, but what I saw I really enjoyed. She says also what is interesting in the movie is that they talk about some mythology about some mythology of the north of Spain. I mean, although it was a rich myth society, not a lot of books or movies pay attention to it. They were kind of Celtics, but they had their own gods and kind of druids and things like that. The artists.
Yes.
The comic book artist who's done the Nashi movie adaptations.
Right, yeah.
His first comic book was a series called Los Mitros de Asturiava. Asturdeva. Fuck, I sound awful.
why doesn't putting in an accent ever help us pronounce these any better? It should. No, for some reason, do an accent just
so. I'm still convinced Elena put shit in her
she
emails
does, she
to
does.
Make me
she
sound
even, she doesn't even spell. She doesn't spell these right, I bet.
she does it just to hear me sound like the freaking tard that I am. Damn it. Jeez. Anyway, apparently this comic book that he did was based on Asturias myths.
Okay.
Nashi and Los Cantabros did it with the Cantabrian ones. Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah,
because
we were talking about how the main character in that, you know, they've never really proved that he really... I mean, not the one that Nashi played. That was a real character.
No, that was
a real
man.
But the leader of the Cantabrians, you know, that they've never actually really proved that he even...
Caracotta may have well been a completely fictitious character.
Right.
Who's just mythological in nature, so She says... then she says, "What can you tell me what Lena Romay film we were reviewing for Beyond Nashi?" She says, "I'm afraid I cannot understand it. I wonder if we just babbled a little too quickly the title."
Did we ever even say the title?
Oh,
no
we
one
did.
Knows. Okay,
we
okay. Did. I was going to say, it would be just like us to like build it all up and then forget to ever say what it actually was. But
that would be hideous.
Well, by now she knows that it is a very badly titled Lorna the Exorcist. So.
Thank you once again, Lena. Elena, you do us great service by helping us out and giving us information about different things.
And keep sending the MP3s, the pronunciations, because even though we never get them right, we love to hear your voice. So
this is true. And yes, if you want to send us any information you can about Night of the Werewolf, reading the names of actors or anything for that, feel free.
Please do. Right. Thank you, Elena.
All right, next up we've got an email from, it's Paul the Mailman.
Paul the Mailman.
I thought you were going to read this one. I was just introing.
We were just letting Paul the Mailman echo off the walls for a few minutes before I started. Okay.
We should put a little echo on it.
So Paul says, "Today was a nice sunny day, so I sat in the backyard doing Sudoku puzzles. Listening to the Nashi cast and getting slowly polluted on cherry lemonades made with 2 parts lemonade to 1 part Smirnoff's cherry vodka. The life of a mailman, you know."
I
any idea that mailmen lived this decadently, I would have gotten that profession years ago.
I suspect that what happened is he got done working, home, and decided it's time to get tanked.
Or to put it another way, ladies and gentlemen, your valuable mail is in the hands of a polluted mailman who are running around drinking Smirnoff. So, anyway, Paul says, "I probably saw the same recording of Los Cantabros that you did, only without the subtitles. I found it on YouTube. In addition to any lack of translation, the picture was a mirror image flipped left to right."
Oh, Jesus. Really?
He says, "I watched it before listening to the podcast. I was surprised at how much I was able to figure out." That's bizarre.
Holy crap.
He said, "Isn't Rod getting all fancy, trotting out his $10 words using sinecure?" To describe Julia Saley's character with her booming voice, she didn't seem to be an insecure sinecure.
this is true. I have to admit, I've got a I really need to kind of explain why just while babbling that word flies out of my mouth. First of all, I have to admit, as with all big fancy $2 words or $10 words that I come across or use, I come across them because I read all the freaking time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I can actually trace a particular strange word to the spot where I first heard it and started to use it. Where I came from this particular word, and there's another word very close to it, is from a comic book. I swear to you, a comic book.
I totally believe you.
In the 1980s, there was a fantastic comic book called Grimjack. Grimjack lived in a city that was a nexus point amongst many, many different worlds and dimensions called Cynosure. And spelled Cynosure. And so when you read that name and you realize what this city is, what this place is, you kind of do some search and you realize, okay, wait a minute. The definition of it is a person or thing that attracts notice because of its brilliance or beauty, or something that serves as a guide. So that's the word that I was thinking of, which is essentially a place of where things come together, kind of a nexus point, something that you can't escape, that all things kind of seem to emanate from, something that strongly attracts attention by its brilliance or interest, something serving for guidance or direction, something of that, something like that. So that's what I'm thinking of, is the city in Grimjack. But there's this other word that is very similar in what it's about, and it seems to have a... almost, sadly enough, maybe use them interchangeably, like some freaking lunatic. But that, to me, is what Julia Salle seemed to be, which is, there was a period of time there where it seemed like he couldn't make a movie without her being in it.
Right, yeah.
And so she seemed to kind of be the thing serving as guidance or direction for him at times. I think in Human Beast, he inserted her into it kind of after the fact.
Yeah.
So... thank you very much. Back to his email now that I've completely bullshitted.
Well, listen, no, I'm totally with you on the whole comic book thing, because I will tell anybody that the what helped my vocabulary more than anything growing up was reading comic books. I mean, it's like some of the biggest words I ever learned. I used to floor my brother all the time and be like, I'd say something, he's like, where did you learn that? I'd say, like, a comic book. I got out of the comic book. Of course, now I could also, fill hours here with telling you about some of the hilarious, not only mispronunciations of those words and how a lot of them I didn't necessarily understand what they meant and still just wanted to drop them into conversation, and you misuse them. There's some hilarious stories about that I won't get into. But in general, I mean, I think I probably learned more big words from comic books than I learned from the elementary school that I was going to, So it greatly expanded my vocabulary. So,
well, it's so funny. I think that the two things that expanded my vocabulary the most are reading comic books incessantly since I was a kid and the far too many semesters I spent delving deeply into Shakespearean tragedies. The deeper you get into the words and those plays, the more that sticks with you. Either that or really bad sitcoms.
There you go.
I can't tell you how many words I learned from Gilligan's Island. Okay. What else is he asking?
Yes. So he says, I pretty much agree with your comments regarding the film. I, too, would certainly like to see a nice, clean print of this Lost and Ashy film. Looking forward to your next two podcasts. I have to check, see if I have copies. If not, they should be easy to track down. Yeah, we're actually, this one and the next one we're doing, we're not too hard to get hold of. So that's, he says, keep up the great work, guys. Paul the Mailman. Paul, thank you, and enjoy that cherry lemonade. Too many lemonades there.
Yes, those sound like a very comfortable way to spend the afternoon, to say the least.
And I will actually say the same thing I always say about my bands, is the more you drink, the better we sound. You can say that about our podcast as well. So, or maybe in our case, it's the more you drink, the more in-depth and more
The more intelligent.
The more intelligent we, the more erudite.
The drunker
we are.
You are, the better, smarter. More erudite we become. it's not that we're any smarter ever. We just sound better. Maybe prescription drugs would help too. I don't know. All right, we've got another letter from Mark. I gotta say, I just got out the third episode of The Bloody Pit, another solo show for me.
Right,
and ended up. I thought I had one letter from Mark, our buddy from across the pond. Mm. I ended up, I actually had two, so I had like three emails to read off, and two of them were from Mark. It's just like, thank God for Mark.
He's keeping, he's like spreading all the good
word.
Well,
he's becoming, you know, we have Jeff, who's our artistic director and your podcaster with us.
Right.
And you know, Mark is like the fourth Beatle here.
we have Dan too, you know, who's like our man in the field there.
Man in the field, Dan.
And they got Elena,
who's a constant companion. True.
So we've got a little our NashiCast family here.
We're small, but we're dedicated.
That's right. And all you writers, people who write into us, we really appreciate this. We love your emails and love your comments. Definitely. But anyway, yes, this is from Mark Wayne. So go ahead.
Mark, he says, "Hey fellas, well, Los Cantabros sounds like a mixed bag. Whilst I wouldn't necessarily call myself a fan of the peplum, I've certainly seen films of this genre that I've enjoyed. However, I do think that if you're going to make an epic-style film on a small budget, then you need a very creative director at the helm, say Mario Bava or Antonio Margheriti. And to be honest, I've always thought Nashi is a better director of people than of action scenes." I'm going to have to agree with you on that, Mark.
Yeah, I was about to say, I can't really argue with that.
I would think that in a lot of ways... there's always that breakdown people say about a lot of film directors, which is there are actors directors, and then there are film directors.
Yeah.
And the kind of film directors are the people who are very good at getting phenomenal images on screen, but they aren't necessarily able to communicate well with actors. And then there are people who are very good with actors who aren't necessarily the greatest at capturing, impressive visuals
really
or
dynamic
spectacle.
Action. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, "Interesting to see you both give such different scores out of 10 for the film. It got me wondering, have your opinions of the films you review on the NashiCast ever differed by more than 2 points? He says, "I can't think of any examples myself."
I couldn't either. I mean, it's like we certainly have disagreed. As far as more than 2 points, I don't know that we've ever really been that extremely...
We have split on... We've split on a couple of... you definitely liked Los Cantabros more than I did.
Right, that's true. Yeah, you said you liked it more with the repeat viewing because you really didn't like it the
first
time.
I really didn't like it.
But never really liked it as much as me. So.
Yeah. It never got better than a 5 for me. Mm-hmm. But you liked it quite a bit.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm trying to think back, and I can't think of a film where you and I differed heavily, where we actually
love and hate. You know, like I love this film, I hate this film. I don't think that we, I know nothing real extreme like that. We've been, you know.
I don't remember. Yeah, I certainly don't. No, I don't remember one that we. Mm-hmm. Crimson, we both hated.
Yeah, and
I
think maybe I might have cut Tomb of the Werewolf a little more slack than you, but we both said it was a bad film. We still said it was a bad film. You know?
Yeah, but we didn't. We certainly weren't 2 points apart.
No, we still thought it was a bad movie. Yeah. So,
Mark, I'm going to have to say I don't.
Yeah,
think
we're so far we're pretty. Yeah, everybody's probably really waiting for us to throw down on one together, but I don't think you know, maybe it'll happen. But so far
the closest we've come is when Troy said nasty things and did not give the proper rating to Avengers of the Mummy.
That's true. Rod's got this mummy blind spot there that's just, you know, that's
not a blind
spot.
It's a very clear vision of what was an excellent film. And you seem to have this prejudice against mummies that I think comes out of
it. I conceded that in the whole sort of, you know, useless mummy genre, it is one of the... I did say it was the second best mummy film ever made. I did say that. That was sort of damning with faint praise, but I did say that it was...
Oh, God, it's good. I don't have a knife in my hand. Okay, so, let's see. Where were you? Okay, let's see. He says, I see Rod is ranting about 3D again.
you should see him ranting in 3D. It's very scary. I have to take my glasses off every now and then.
You don't want to know. He says, "I have to be honest, I have no real problem with 3D movies. I know the process is often used to mask an otherwise lackluster film, but the quality of the 3D image these days is pretty amazing, particularly compared to its migraine-inducing 1980s counterpart. As far as I'm concerned, if the big studios are going to continue churning out crap for idiots, then 3D at least makes it slightly more palatable. Believe me, my daughter forced me to watch Justin Bieber Never Say Never.
Oh, man, oh, man.
So I know what I'm talking about." Oh, holy shit, Mark.
Oh, wow.
So the Justin Bieber thing is worldwide? They have to suffer through that shit in England, too?
Yeah, apparently so.
Oh, fuck. I'm sorry, UK listeners. You poor bastards. I thought that was something only us dumb American fuckers had to cope with. Wow, Bieber. Bieber. That's okay. I got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I hurt for you, buddy. I really do.
Jesus Christ, you poor side.
But no, I have to say I'm pretty indifferent to the whole 3D thing myself.
Really?
You know, I mean, now I'll put it this way. I will enjoy if it's truly filmed in 3D. These 3D enhanced things, you
that's
can
bullshit,
you can yeah. And I know he's talking about real 3D. Yeah, I mean, and certainly it's so much more improved. I mean, he's right. I mean, it's actually it's not painful to say. I know what he's talking about, and you know, it's not painful to sit through. It's well done.
Correct.
It's just you know, it's not a huge selling point. I guess drawing point with me is what I'd say. You know,
I think not wanting to get off on another rant.
Right.
My real discomfort with it is not with the process or its effectiveness. It's with the fact that they want to charge you an extra chunk of change to see the movie in this particular process, and I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah. You're right. The extra bucks
really
you have to pay for.
I think it's just highly amusing that there are people who are buying quote unquote 3D televisions.
That's something that that's something I can never picture myself being interested in doing. I was like, no, I can really do without the 3D television.
No. Right now, my big concern is I want to mount our television on the wall. Mm-hmm. You know, on one of those things where you can, you know, you can swing it out from the wall and tilt it around the room. That's all. That's my thing. That's what I want to do. Not have some bullshit 3D thing going on.
Now, I will say this: I've heard rumblings that they're supposed to be a really major print of Creature from the Black Lagoon in 3D. That Universal.
It's supposed to be. It's going to be on that Universal Blu-ray set that's coming out. Well, it's about to come out here in October.
Yeah, but I mean, aren't they going to be?
It's going to be the 3D version of it's going to be on the Blu-ray.
Okay, but isn't it also supposed to make its rounds of the theaters and so a few theaters?
Oh,
I think it's supposed to be.
Well, dude, I saw the old Anaglyph 3D print of Creature from the Black Lagoon years ago, back when I was in high school. I mean, that occasionally gets shown.
Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, would this be the best it's ever looked with the 3D? Might be even more improved. I mean, it was always good, but I unfortunately went and saw one time here in Nashville. It was a great idea. It just, they showed, you know, the movies in the park they do here.
Mm-hmm.
They showed Revenge of the, or you know, not
Revenge
Creature,
of the Creature.
And, but it was, the print was so, I mean, that was a painful one to sit through. It was cool that they were showing it, but the 3D was so hard to look at because the print itself was so washed out that it just made it all, you know, every now and then you just had to take your glass off and close your eyes for a minute. It was one of those things where you wanted to enjoy it, you know, but it was just too hard to watch.
That can happen. There are a lot of people who can't watch 3D movies, period, because it gives them a headache. Forced thing, what it does to your eyes to give you that effect, gives them a headache. I mean, it just some people can't do it. My thing is, you know, you just brought this up. Let me.
Oh, here's another rant. I know what he's gonna rant on. Here it comes.
Let's talk about this for just one second. I won't go too long on this, but God damn it.
Yeah, I know.
Let's be blunt for just a fucking second here. This really does piss me off. Universal is issuing the Universal Monster movies, the classics from the 30s, and 30s and 40s, the big ones on Blu-ray,
mm-hmm.
with a bunch of extras and yada, yada, yada. It's like the 80 billionth fucking time they put them out on disc, right?
Yeah.
And they're putting them out, and the sons of bitches are still shortchanging us, because I swear to you, if you're going to charge me for this big set, $100+ for this big freaking set of movies, and your big selling point is, hey, we've spruced up Dracula again, and ooh, we're finally going to give you the 3D version of The Creature from the Black Lagoon, you need to put all the fucking movies on these Blu-rays. I want all three Creature films. I want
all the Wolfman films,
all the Frankenstein movies, all of them. Not just Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula. No. Don't fucking shortchange me, you cheapskate bastards. Because what I know you're going to do is down the road, you're going to issue more fucking Blu-rays, and you're finally going to put all those films, because they'll all fit. They'll all fit on the fucking thing.
Well, here's the thing that bothers me about it is because if I thought that, say, next year we would get then a Blu-ray or we would get future Blu-rays with the rest of the Wolfmans, the rest of the Dracula, you know, the rest of the Frankensteins.
Yeah.
It won't happen. They're not going to put Ghost of Frankenstein, and unless, like they said, unless they do what you said, which is they repackage it with the classics again and then put it out in another $800 set or whatever. You know,
that's what they're going to do.
Yeah,
which is why it's like, you know, I have the last versions of them they put out on disc on DVD,
mm-hmm.
where you bought the Frankenstein set and it had all the Frankenstein movies, and you bought the Wolfman set
and all the movies.
Thank God, that's what I want.
Yeah, I got all that.
I've got all the Mummy movies in one thing, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah,
and it. You would have had my money. You would have had my money, you sons of bitches, if you just put all those movies together on this Blu-ray set. I would have found a way to justify it in my head. I would have freaking done it, and you bastards can't get your
it's Universal, man. They've always fucked that franchise up. You know, they don't know what they've got. They milk it, but they don't milk it. Well, it's because it's that whole contempt for the audience. It's like, you know, it's like, we're happy to sell you this stuff, but we don't really respect that you like horror. You know, we don't really respect you like these movies. You know, we don't really respect you for liking these movies, but we're happy to take your money. So we're going to just keep licensing and then put them out in all these ways that you'll buy them. Mm. You know, so there's no, let me ask you, so those main films, there's no improvement enough they could do, though, on those prints that would make you... Because I'm hearing they look awesome, is what I'm hearing.
They're going to look awesome. Yeah. Of course they are. They're going to do the hard work to spruce those things up and make them look as good as they possibly can.
Right.
But they're fucking you.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
They're not giving you... I want the entire run. I want to watch the minor films. Damn it! I want Ghost of Frankenstein. I want House of Dracula. Me too. I want to see.
Here's my little minor rant I'll add to that. I've had this rant ever since they've been doing these films. Is whenever they do these series of films, I mean, they do it not just with the Universal ones. You know, they do it with all, every time they undertake a film series. You know, they did it with the Gamera. You know, that great set that Shout Factory did of the Gamera films, which was, you know, was awesome. The DVD films, but they always give you audio commentaries. And extras on the main films, but they won't give them to you on the minor films, you know, and that drives me nuts because everything in the world has been said about the major films. We want to hear more about. I mean, I would love to hear Greg Mank do Ghost of Frankenstein, you know, but it's like, no, we're going to make him do the major films because they think that's all that.
I agree with you. I would love to hear.
I agree there may not be enough material out there.
I think there's plenty of material, especially considering the short run times these films have. I think there's plenty of material. Mm-hmm. Plenty of material. Mm-hmm. But I think what you run into is there's a bit of, and I'm gonna use the word, there's a bit of snobbery involved.
Oh, of course there is.
With those lesser films, quote unquote lesser films, those sequel movies. Where you suddenly have, I mean, there are people.
But I know how much you love those mummy films. Wouldn't you love to hear an audio commentary on every one of those mummy films?
Yes, I would. But here's the thing: even when they were doing the original audio commentaries for DVD, there was that joke amongst people that once they got down to the Wolfman, there were a lot of those big name writers who were nowhere to be seen. They didn't want to have anything to do with the Wolfman because it's seen as a lesser film.
I see what you're saying. If they don't want to have
anything to do with the quote unquote lesser film, The Wolfman, for fuck's sake, then they're never going to get anywhere near The Mummy's Ghost or House of Dracula or any of that stuff.
So you're saying you're thinking they're actually.
I think there's a bit of snobbery.
So you're thinking you're talking about in terms of finding someone to do audio commentaries. Correct. Well, you would do the ones on The Mummy if they asked you, I bet.
Well, yeah, but I mean, okay, I'm not necessarily the guy to do that. I don't have access. I mean, if they would give me access, if they would fucking pay me, of course, I'd be glad to do it. It'd be great.
Totally see what you're saying. Is like, there's probably like, and you know those writers, you know how those guys are that love this stuff. There's such competitiveness between them. They're going to get mad if they're like, well, you asked him to do the Wolfman, but you want me to do Frankenstein meets the Wolfman? Forget it. You know, it's like, that kind of thing. It's that kind of thing. It's like, no, you know, you should have asked me to do. So yeah, I understand that. You're getting it out. Well, like I say, with the Gamera thing, I mean, it sucked because, I mean, it's a great series of DVDs, and I'm so glad they're there. I mean, they're wonderfully done, but, you know, they did audio commentaries on the first two, and then, of course, you know, and I thought, oh, this is going to be awesome, you know, audio commentaries on every one of them, because they were great commentaries, and they just stopped with the first two, and the rest of them, they didn't do it, and that kind of stuff drives me nuts, you know? I'm just like, no, don't do it on the ones that everybody knows. Do it on the lesser films. Yeah. That's the ones we want to learn more about.
I agree. Mark, as usual, your email has touched off a fucking rant. Not just for me, but from Troy.
I know now. Okay, let me wipe off the spittle off the recorder here, and we will continue with Mark's letter.
Anyway.
Now, I love this part here. This is my favorite part of Mark's letter. I want you to read this.
Okay, Mark says, your statement that Andreas Resino is Eva Leone's father had me resting my chin on my hand and saying, If you watch them respectively in Seven Murders for Scotland Yard and Blue Eyes the Broken Doll, they both look to be in their 20s. Is there perhaps an Andreas Resino Sr. or an Eva Leone Jr.?
No. Andreas Resino was her husband, and Rod got that wrong in two straight podcasts. The first time...
Oh, I know, I fucked it up.
The first time I corrected him, the second time I decided to let it go because I wanted to see...
You let me hang myself.
I did, because I knew that I could count on one of our astute listeners to do the... to pull the lever or whatever for me. Thank you, Mark. We have now lynched Rod on the air for screwing that up.
Thank
by
you.
Calling poor, saying that poor Andre Rizzo was you. Too old and impotent to bring pleasure to Eva Leone. So.
Okay, yes. This all stems from me misreading one line while trying to keep my eyes on two different things at one time and totally fucking it up and saying, oh, God, father instead of husband. It was totally stupid. Yeah. I screwed up. Troy was nice enough to correct me once.
Yeah.
And let me hang myself on the second one.
You only
one,
get so. Once and one chance. Dude, so.
You only die twice. Yeah. So, yes. My apologies. You have reason to sneer at me for that fuck up. It was stupid. So, yes, yes. Mea culpa. All right. Back. Let's go back to Mark's email where now I get lynched again. No.
Yeah.
He says, looking forward to your next two Nashy casts. Nice to see you finally getting around to doing Night of the Werewolf. Mm-hmm. Although it's sad to note that this will be your last Danensky podcast.
That's why we pushed it back so far.
Yeah. I'm also very interested to see what you think of Lorna the Exorcist. My prediction, Troy will like it better than Rob.
Oh, now who's looking at
I've forgotten he wrote that.
Yeah, well, Mark, you're not such a smarty pants after all, are you?
Turns out, I liked it more.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Interesting. Mark, you keep writing in, buddy.
Yeah, that's right, man. Just keep making coming. You make those little predictions there. And
Oh, my God. All right. Mark, once again, thank you very much for the email. You are always a great addition.
Provocative,
to
say the least. All right.
Oh, no, it's great, man. I mean, it's wonderful to have somebody who cares this much and is willing to participate so much in the podcast. It's fantastic. Thank you.
And all of you can participate. You can share in the fun, too. It's as simple as writing to nashycast@gmail.com.
That's nashycast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do radio voice.
Yeah,
for
thank
a
you.
I'm sorry.
Nashycast@gmail.com. We need to come up with a little. Yeah, little,
we
little
should have
sing-a-line.
A jingle. We'd like to thank everybody for people who write into us. We'd like to thank you. Mm-hmm. We once again want to do a shout out and a big thank you to our buddy Jeff Nelson for his amazing artwork for each and every podcast. He does wonderful work for us. Mm-hmm. Poor sucker. Poor sucker's getting married.
Yeah, I know. He is. But
it's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. But he's promised to interrupt his honeymoon to do some artwork for it.
Oh, God. I mean, he's a quick turnaround artist. But everyone who helps us out, Elena, Dan, everyone, you do so much for us, and all we do is provide a couple of hours of babble per month, and we can't thank you enough. You do wonderful things for us, and we are so glad you're there to help us out.
And let's say, last but not least, thanks to Lena Romay for the career she had, for the film she made, pleasure she gave us, and we enjoy her films and always will. So rest in peace, Lena.
You gave us lots of things to think about and lots of things to lust over.
That's right.
You are always a pleasure.
Yes, very much
so. In many different ways. So we want to thank everybody for listening in. If you've ever downloaded one of our shows and listened to it, you have done us a favor.
Yeah,
you've listened to us babble, and you've not thought of us as complete idiots, or hey, maybe you have. I don't know.
Say hi on our Facebook page. Post things on our Facebook page. Clue us in on anything cool you find out there.
Yeah, please do.
Rod also keep up with his side podcast, The Bloody Pit of Rod. He's got 3 episodes up now.
And more
kind of in the works. I don't know how much you want to say about those. You want to kind of keep them under wraps, but we got.
I can't really talk about anything until we get it recorded.
But things are in the works. Yeah, things are in the works.
Things are definitely in the works. Hoping to get to. It took 3 months to get this one out, and it's only an hour and a half long. Jeez, that was ridiculous. But. Yeah.
Well, and the next time you hear us, hopefully you our plan is anyway that you'll be in the we'll be just a little bit before Halloween, because we've saved Night of the Werewolf for our Halloween episode, our October episode. We thought that'd be perfect.
That is our hope. So remember, folks, next time episode 32 mm-hmm. will be Night of the Werewolf, our last Danensky podcast of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we do some kind of weird wrap up show. So yeah. Please join us here again in just a few short weeks. For Night of the Werewolf, an easier one to get your hands on, folks. It had an actual DVD release over here in Region 1 land. Thank you once again, and I guess we'll talk to you again next time. My name is Rod Barnett.
And I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we will talk to you soon.